Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by the internet entrepreneur Jimmy Wales. Starting his career in the city, Jimmy went on to found Wikipedia in 2001. It's now grown to be the world's largest encyclopedia, with 270 million page views a day and 40 million articles in 293 languages. His latest venture is taking on fake news. WikiTribune launched early this year, an online publication combining professional journalism with contributions from volunteers. In 2006, he was named one of Time magazine's 100 Most Influential People, and in 2007, he was named one of Forbes' Top 25 Web Celebs. Jimmy, thank you for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Jimmy, tons of questions, but let's start at the beginning. What did you do before Wikipedia? What was the journey that got you to right to the start?
Yeah, so I was a futures and options trader in Chicago. So I had been working on a PhD in finance, and I published a paper on option pricing theory called On the Pricing of Index Options When All of the Underlying Assets Follow a Log-Normal Diffusion.
I'm nodding. I don't understand any of it. I acknowledge their words.
Neither do I anymore. But I was trading mainly LIBOR and Fed funds, futures contracts, and some currencies and options and things like that, and really enjoyed it. It was good. But I was also very, very interested in the internet and really saw a lot of interesting and exciting things happened there. And so basically started with a friend, Tim Schell. He and I started just doing things on the internet.
Stuff.
So we just had a lot of ideas and we were working on all kinds of different projects. I remember we had one site that we set up that I was actually quite excited by called Loop Lunch. So the downtown Chicago area is called the Chicago Loop. And
love Chicago. Been there a few times.
Yeah, we thought people, you know, ordering food online is going to be a big thing someday. So we thought
off.
And it didn't take off because back in, this was probably around 97, you know, restaurant owners looked at me like I was from Mars when I tried to talk them into putting their business online. Like, they had no idea what that meant even. You know, it was really much too early. Now, obviously, ordering food online is a huge business and very successful, but didn't really work out. So did a lot of different things with some early blogging. Had a like a search engine web directory where – and that was in some ways a precursor to Wikipedia in just the idea we had is instead of – this is – really before it became obvious that Google was going to win and that algorithms would be the way that we do search. And so if you remember, Yahoo had a like a web directory.
It was curated, wasn't
it? Curated by humans
on
staff. And I said, well, why don't we just see if the public will curate the directory. And so people could come and build what we called a web ring, a list of links. And we integrated them, you know, into a search engine. And it, you know, it worked. We got some traffic, and it was, you know, it worked reasonably well. But you know, in the end, that wasn't the right technology for search. So then we had some early blogging, never really successful with that. And so then had the idea for an encyclopedia. Started a project called Newpedia, which is the precursor to Wikipedia. And Newpedia was the same vision, free encyclopedia for everyone. But with Newpedia, we really had a very top-down system. It was, you know, a seven-stage review process to get anything published. You had to fax in your credentials. It was very, very slow.
I'm not surprised if you had to fax in your credentials.
It was really old-fashioned. And the reason we did it that way is that, you know, I'd hired Larry Sanger to be editor-in-chief, and he persuaded me, and he was right, given the state of our knowledge at the time, but wrong, given what we learned later, that if an online encyclopedia written by volunteers would be ever accepted, it needed to be very highly credible and need to be more academic than a traditional encyclopedia, which made sense and actually in some ways presaged some of the way the public viewed Wikipedia in the early days, which was with great skepticism, I would say. And so, you know, we had this system, and I, you know, after 2 years, we got about 24 articles finished. And I always joke, I keep them by my bedside and read them every night. And I'll eventually get my money's worth. But
I don't know why, but I'm thinking of that episode of Blackadder, you know, where they do the dictionary and they get stuck on that on Aardvark.
Right. That's fantastic, except remember, I'm American. I barely know what Blackadder is.
Well, I thought you guys loved it. Well, you should watch it.
I should watch it. I actually am slowly but surely catching up on cultural references. So in the end, when I realized it wasn't going to work was when I decided this was when Robert Merton won the Nobel Prize in Economics for his work on option pricing theory, which I happen to know quite a lot about and published academic work in that area. And so I thought, well, I can write a short biography. We had the idea for the encyclopedia then was we would have short biographies and long biographies. So I thought, well, I'll start with the short one. And 5 paragraphs, and it was very intimidating, and it wasn't fun because I knew they were going to take my draft and send it to the most prestigious finance professors they could find
who
to critique
to pieces.
It.
Yeah.
And I was like, that wasn't fun back in grad school. It's definitely not fun now.
It's my idea of hell.
Yeah, absolute hell. And actually, to sort of bookend that story, so then I said, well, look, this isn't fun. No one is going to do anything that isn't fun. And to kind of bookend that with another story, and I need to remember which one it was, and I don't, so I apologize for that, but one day, several years later, after Wikipedia had started, I just happened to be online and I saw, you know, news alert pop up. Someone had won the Nobel Prize in Economics, and I quickly went to Wikipedia to, oh, I want to learn about who's won this year. And we didn't have an entry. And so I quickly started an entry and I just said, you know, so-and-so has won the Nobel Prize in Economics and hit save. And that's all you need to start an entry. Obviously, it's not very good.
A stub,
exactly. And people quickly started filling it in and adding more and so forth. And that, you know, that is the experience with Wikipedia, is that everybody can do their own small part. You can add a reference. You can, you know, start a new entry that's very short, things like that. Whereas in the old days, it was a very heavy, very difficult process. So that was a real change. And when we launched Wikipedia, which came about because we'd stumbled across the idea of a wiki editing and decided, hey, this might be a good tool we could use to get the work done a little more easier and faster. We got more work done in about 2 weeks than we had done in almost 2 years. So that was like a real eye-opener, like, okay, wow, this is really, you know, and nowadays in Silicon Valley, everybody calls that a pivot. We didn't call it that back then. We just sort of like, that's not working. Let's try this. And
how did you see yourself at that moment? Were you a futures trader that was dabbling in the internet, or did you see yourself as a kind of burgeoning internet entrepreneur?
Definitely internet entrepreneur. I had left trading. I'd left Chicago. I was living in San Diego, California. I moved to San Diego when, you know, I had a small amount of investment from my former boss, and the company was doing well. And actually, we were doing very well for a brief period of time. There was a period of time during the dot-com boom when there was so much money flowing into the industry that advertising rates were very high. And we partnered with NBCI for a while. So the whole domain moved to bombus.nbci.com. They didn't buy us. They just contracted with us to manage this site sort of on their network. And at the time, NBC is, of course, a huge television network in the U.S., and they decided that TV networks were going to dominate the internet and search. So they had this huge search engine project, and they were losing about $100 million a quarter, some small percentage of that to me. But we were 10% of their traffic for a while.
Wow.
And then that all turned sour because they obviously couldn't sustain that for very long. And so at the period of time when Wikipedia was launched, I was definitely doing internet full time, living in San Diego, where I'd moved because although I do love Chicago as a city, weather is dreadful. And I just thought,
it's part of its charm.
I'm from the deep south in Alabama, and I want good weather. And I thought, well, where's good weather? And San Diego has the best weather in the world.
So. You want good jazz. Chicago's the best place in the world for that.
Yeah, no, I mean, even today I love visiting Chicago. It's just those winters just don't suit me.
I agree.
And it's actually a very good experience living in Chicago and now living here in the UK. I really fully understand what a bunch of whiny moaners you all are about the weather.
And rightly so.
It's not that bad, you know. It's a bit...
Coming down in buckets, as Paddington Bear would say.
Yeah, exactly. So people here think they have bad weather, but honestly, you've not seen it until you've lived in Chicago.
Well, I'm going to ask you about life here in the UK and how you came to be here. Yeah, but let's just, if we may, let's just carry on with the journey to kind of Wikipedia. When was the first, I mean, you've already talked to kind of the first pivot, even though it wasn't called that then. When was the first stage where you thought, wow, we really are onto something here?
Yeah, I mean, I would say one of the early times was really, you know, 2 weeks in, seeing we'd gotten quite a lot of work done in 2 weeks, and that was, interesting. Another big moment was on September 11th, September 11th, 2001, the huge terrorist attack in the U.S. And that was the first time I really saw how Wikipedia could respond to news events, and it was different from anything else I had seen. So on that day, there was suddenly a huge spike of traffic on the site to articles that were somehow related to background information for what had happened. So people were reading or editing or starting entries on the World Trade Center and the architect who designed the World Trade Center and all the airlines who were involved that day and all that kind of background information, various, you know, on the day of, nobody knew who was this, so people were interested in who are some of the, you know, Al-Qaeda, who's Al-Qaeda, right? We needed an entry about that and to expand that. And so suddenly you saw, oh, actually, there's a huge demand by the public for background information, for things that flash up on the news, and people are like, oh, wow, what, you know, what's that? I need to learn more about that. And so that was really, you know, a very interesting moment in time to realize, oh, actually, we can play a part in the needs that the public has for information, that when people do, and even today we see this, if there's something big in the news, we see huge traffic spikes. You know, if there's an earthquake and it destroys some small town in Italy, hill town or something, wow, boom, like we'll see a huge spike of traffic about the village, about the area, because people are very interested to know, not just, oh, something terrible's happened in Italy, but well, who are these people? What is this place? You know, so that's that was a big learning.
I mean, this is a compliment, but it's almost impossible to imagine life without Wikipedia now. It's just so ubiquitous. Yeah. I can remember the very first moment I realized that it was going to be a major part of my life is I used to watch Knight Rider, you know, with David Hasselhoff when he had the talking car. And I was kind of, I wanted a list of episodes. I can't remember why. This is like well over 10 years ago. And of course, there's a Wikipedia article with every single episode in every order, the director, a critical analysis of each episode. I mean, it was just the greatest thing that's not only ever happened to me, but still remains happened to me.
No, it's really amazing. And, you know, I think a lot of people have that type of moment. I remember in the early days, we had about 30,000 entries, and we grew to about 60,000 entries very quickly because a guy named Ramman, that was his online handle, had created something called Rambot. And it wasn't really artificial intelligence or anything like that, but it was a very simple template for every city, state, town, village in the United States. So he wrote the template. He had all the data from the U.S. Census and other like government sources. He showed it to the community for review, and people suggested edits and changes to make the template better. Then he ran the bot and created entries for every little tiny place in the U.S. And not long after that, you know, I got an email from someone saying, oh, wow, I'd heard about this encyclopedia. I can't believe you have an entry about my little hometown with 300 people. That's amazing. And, of course, it was just a not a very sophisticated bot, but it was just filling in data. Again, that was very interesting. And, you know, what was also interesting to me in those early days is, although we were just, you know, had no commercial model whatsoever, a lot of the early community members, I would say, were as sort of hotly competitive and interested in our traffic as any sort of aggressive .com people would have been. So we really watched a lot of things. Like we watched I used to post a regular page saying what Google likes, and basically I'd just go through the server logs and see what are we getting traffic from Google from, and then that gave us ideas. So we would see, oh, actually, you know, we're getting a lot of traffic from Google for capitals of countries. Okay, well, let's get all the capitals of all the countries.
Oh, episodes of Knight Rider.
Episodes of Knight Rider, exactly. Maybe somebody posted one, and then we said, oh, that one's doing well. Let's write all the rest of them. No, perhaps not. But so, you know, It was very interesting, sort of working with the community and seeing the site grow very, very quickly. So that was all very, very exciting.
And did you have a monetization strategy at that point, or were you kind of thinking almost like Field of Dreams, you know, build it, they will come, let's get to a huge critical mass of people and then we'll do something with it to make us rich?
Yeah, it was definitely Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come. Didn't really have a clear idea of a business model. And, you know, certainly in the early days, there were thoughts of, okay, maybe we'll put ads someday. Maybe, you know, I didn't really want to do that. People proposed, you know, oh, well, could we charge for it? No, it doesn't really make sense because volunteers are writing it. And why would you want to write something that's going to be charged for? It doesn't really make sense.
It doesn't motivate people, does it?
If it's not freely available. So, and very quickly, I really did feel quite strongly that there was something inherently cultural about Wikipedia. And so decided to go ahead and put it into the nonprofit structure. And that really, what really pushed that was the growth. The growth was such that we had three servers, and I remember this really quite spectacular sort of Christmas day when two of the servers died on the same day on Christmas. And
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. And by this time I had moved to Florida. The servers were physically in a facility in California. My developer was also on holiday, so he was away. So I had to sort of get online and quickly reconfigure things and run on one server for like a few days, which was very difficult, huge amounts of traffic. But so prior to that, I was saying back in the summer.
You can't do any load balancing when there's only one server,
yeah, exactly,
can you?
Not much load balancing available. And back in, this was in the olden days, there was no sort of Amazon Web Services where you can just spin up 1,000 servers very quickly. You had to actually buy them and physically install them in a facility.
I remember it well. I used to have a cluster of servers at Telehouse in Canary Wharf.
And I used to have to go in and, with screwdrivers and like put them in the racks and things. So.
We used to have to pay a security guard at night £50 if the server needed a physical reset. He'd go up to the rack and press the reset button. And Telehouse would charge us £50 for doing
amazing,
that.
Amazing, amazing.
Unbelievable.
So I had seen that coming. And so back in the previous summer, I'd put it into the nonprofit organization because I could see, like, wow, this is growing so quickly, we're going to need more servers. And so we still limped along until that time. And then I said, okay, look, we need more servers. Like, we can't, even three was starting to get to struggle. So we worked together as a community and we picked out eight servers and decided, okay, let's do a fundraiser. So that was a moment when, for the first time, we asked the public to help fund Wikipedia. So we were already set up as a charity, but we still didn't know for sure because you could be a charity and also have advertising. So National Geographic magazine is a great example. So that wasn't completely off the table as an option, but obviously was not desirable. So we said, okay, well let's see. And so I set out. I was hoping to raise $20,000 in about a month's time. And this is obviously pre-Kickstarter and all that. So, you know, we just tried things, you know. And we had about $30,000 within a couple of weeks. It
wow.
went incredibly well. There was just a huge outpouring. And it was partly from the editing community. People chipped in what they could. It was partly readers, you know, thought, oh, this is great. People from the open source movement, geek culture, like people just thought this was worth supporting. You know, somebody gave, I think, $500. I was like floored by that. That was amazing. And it got us enough money to buy those servers. And then traffic went way up because once we had a better, you know, group of servers, then the site was faster and pages loaded faster and traffic just grew and grew. So then I say for the first few years, it was all about that. Sort of trying to cope with that growth and
reacting to the huge demand.
Yeah, just reacting to the huge demand. And we really saw the traffic shoot up every time we bought more servers because it really made the site faster again. And so, and you know, the first doubling from one to two servers, that's like, oh, this is growing. And then from, you know, two to three and three to eight. And then you go to 16 and 32 and you're like, wow, this is getting to be quite a big deal.
Were you so busy kind of reacting to the technical challenge that you didn't have time to reflect on what you wanted Wikipedia to be? Because,
yeah, and,
you know, because
well,
I was thinking about
yes
the...
Yes and no. So, yeah, let's go ahead, though.
I was just going to say, because in terms of the highly altruistic motivation of that person who gave $500, but also the altruism was matched by your altruism. In a sense, you'd given this gift to wider society. I was about to say humanity, but I think it's a gift to humanity now, but maybe then it was just a fight for survival.
Well, I mean, for me, I actually don't like the word altruism. So for me, it's quite a selfish thing to build the world you want to live in. So I think of altruism as doing something against your own interests or against your values. It's a complicated philosophical point, but
I shall read the Wikipedia entry on it after this.
But what I would say is that the technical challenges were a big part of how we had to spend time thinking, but also the community growth was also something of keen focus. But so what I would say is that there was a period of time when the community was very healthy, the website was very healthy, the tech, you know, everything was moving fine, but the actual Wikimedia Foundation, which is the organization that I set up, the nonprofit, wasn't healthy. I was so busy, I started traveling and going out and meeting community members and sort of promoting Wikipedia and learning more. And we didn't have enough staff. We didn't have the right experience. And it was really like, it was a big struggle. We made a lot of mistakes in hiring and, you know, just things didn't work out so well. And that was like, you know, like annoying. And in fact, set the stage for things that today are mostly sort of healed up and better, but you know, some friction between the community and the foundation, simply because the foundation wasn't able to respond well, and so on. And now things are much better, and there's, you know, that's all good. But you know, in those early days, that was quite a lot of tough challenges there, because we managed to grow without really having a proper organization behind it. So then we did then eventually. We hired Sue Gardner, and she really, you know, really came in and really sort of made us into a proper organization and took us from, I forget when she came, there were maybe, I'm going to say 8 employees, if that, 5, 8, something like that, very small. And she took us, you know, I don't know how many were when she left, but 200 maybe, 150, I can't remember, but quite a lot. And so that was really a crucial period of time.
Was the time for you to reflect kind of philosophically on where you wanted Wikipedia to go during this time? Or were you because you speak to a lot of business owners, you know, or any organization, if they're in that inflationary phase, they often literally just don't have time because they're so busy reacting to stuff. Well, you know, was there a few kind of philosophical milestones in your own mind about, is this going in the right direction? I'm going to kind of have a course correction here, etc.
I mean, not really, because I mean, the thing about Wikipedia is it's such a simple, pure idea that a free encyclopedia for everyone in their own language is quite straightforward, and it was also very clarifying. So when questions would come up, so, you know, for example, people would say, oh, should we offer free webmail accounts? Okay. No, we shouldn't. That was a time when lots of places started doing that, and of course Gmail came out and was so good, like you wouldn't try to do that. But it was like, yeah, that's not really building an encyclopedia. And yes, of course, users might use these email addresses, and it just wasn't for us. So by sticking to the very straightforward, simple things, that's what had been successful and what made us successful. And I think there is a lesson there for entrepreneurs in general about just, it's hard enough to do one thing well. So don't try to do 7 things well. You're better off just like really focusing in and doing your main thing. It also helps you concentrate because you know your objective and you just stick to that.
If this isn't too sycophantic a question, you must be proud of how globally impactful Wikipedia is. I mean, you once mentioned that, I think in my research, you said you wanted Wikipedia to be the sum total of all human knowledge. Do you think we are getting there? I mean, if you were to ask the man on the street what is the site most likely to have everything in it that humans know, it's they're going to name Wikipedia.
Yeah, I mean, it's humbling and it's fascinating to be a part of this community who've done all these amazing things. And it's an interesting philosophical question, you know, how big can Wikipedia be? Because, you know, you can't have an entry about literally everything on the planet. You know, I'm just sitting here, I've got a coffee cup here, and there's really nothing you could write about this coffee cup.
Is it called the notability criteria?
Notability, yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
We've gone into
and,
that.
And that's, it's interesting because not everything is notable. And I actually don't, for me, the word notable is a bit problematic because when it refers to people, it can be a little bit hurtful for people to hear, oh, you're not notable. Oh, well, what does that mean? You're insulting me. It's not about that. It's really about, are there quality sources? Can we write a biography? Many people, even people who come into the public eye, not much is known about them other than their public work. And so unless there's been some profiles or something of them as a person, you can't really write a biography. And that's, you know, varies across different fields and things like that. To what extent can you do this? You know, how big can Wikipedia be? There's someone in the community who makes lists and works on this as a philosophical question. And I forget, somebody told me, I think the number that he's come up with is like 30 million things that could be in Wikipedia. It might be 20 million. I don't quote me on that, but it's a fun question. And so, you know, if you think there was a few years back at one of our annual conferences, we have an annual conference called Wikimania, where several hundred of the community members come together and talk best practices and what's going on in their language version of Wikipedia, etc. And there was this guy who brought with him, he's from Poland, it was a Polish concise dictionary of biographies. So this book, one volume book, you know, quite a heavy, big book, had 20,000 entries in it of famous Polish people. And he had done some random sampling and looking in both Polish Wikipedia and English Wikipedia, and we had only 5% of them. So many of these people who are in there, arguably you could have a Wikipedia entry about them, but we don't. So who are they? So, for example, who is the mayor of Warsaw in 1781, right? Okay, somebody.
And now you can write a biography of it.
Yeah. I'm very curious myself. I'm curious to know how many mayors of Warsaw do we have full entries on. But the point is, we might not have an entry on someone like that, even though we could. There will be, you know, press archives. There'll be things that you could write. And so when you think about it, there's actually quite a lot. But it gets more and more difficult because, I mean, who's really going to bother? Who's interested? But, you know, if someone's interested enough to write every episode of Knight Rider, somebody eventually will say, hey, all the mayors of Warsaw, that's my job. That's what I'm going to chip in on. So, you know, there's a long way to go. And then that's just, you know, if we think about English Wikipedia, it's over 5 million entries. But our goal is a free encyclopedia for every single person on the planet in their own language. And so that means all the languages of the developing world. There's a long way to go there. A few years back, I kind of formalized it to say, well, what I really want is 250,000 articles in every language that has at least 1 million speakers. Because
wow.
That's just it's kind of arbitrary cutoff point.
It's a yardstick.
It's a yardstick, yeah. Because there are languages that are only spoken by 20 people, and you're never going to have a comprehensive encyclopedia in that language unless those 20 people write it, which is unlikely. So you can't consider the project a failure if we didn't get that far. But so on that metric, there's about 330 languages that meet that criteria of having at least 1 million speakers. And right now we've got, I think, about 40 or 50 languages are you know, quite large. And then there's a lot of smaller languages, and some of them are doing well and growing. Some of them are not. Some of them are just very small. And so for me, that's very interesting. And I might have to go back and reassess how we're doing against that metric and also think about, is that really the right metric? I think 10 years ago, I thought that up. Because one of the things that does happen is we have local languages in areas with strong regional languages. And so in Africa, there are oftentimes, you know, there'll be a language with a million speakers and another language with a million speakers, another language with a million speakers, but all those people will also speak Swahili or the regional language. So that means, okay, in order to serve people with education, do we really need all those languages? Well, I think we do, but it's also meaningful that they have that. A classic type of example is Welsh. So Welsh Wikipedia is small, but it's thriving and growing well. And arguably, not many people need a Welsh encyclopedia. Almost everyone who speaks Welsh also speaks English. I mean, there might be a few grannies in villages somewhere who only speak Welsh. But in general, it's a mother tongue. It's a tongue, you know, language spoken at home. Some would argue a dying language. I'm not so sure that's true.
A heritage language.
I actually think a lot of these languages are being saved by the internet, by communities having the opportunity to write an encyclopedia in their mother tongue, where there might not be an economic justification for publishing one.
But that doesn't have to be the sole justification.
And in this case, it doesn't have to be the justification at all. People can do it because they love their heritage, they love their mother tongue, and they want to keep it alive. So
how does it work in terms of, like, say if you take, and I'm just thinking aloud here, but if you take the Wikipedia entry for Cyprus, there'll be the English version of it, but then is the Turkish version of it a mere translation and the same article will be in Turkish, or is there a cultural bias where they would view Cyprus differently?
So the way this works is that every language is written completely independently. Obviously, sometimes people translate things. In fact, one of the reasons that English is the largest language is that people write in their mother tongue, but they also translate it into English. But in general, no, it's written independently. But because we have a very strong culture of neutrality and very strong sort of push in the community for neutrality, we try to minimize that kind of cultural bias. Obviously, it creeps in from time to time. It often creeps in places that are not controversial, and so it goes unnoticed. So there'll be, things like the status of a small island that's in dispute between two countries, but it's not like an active dispute that everybody's up in arms about. And you'll see that sometimes that there is, you know, this is an island that belongs to
country A.
Country A. Mm. And, you know, a little note at the bottom saying country B for some reason thinks they own it, you know, and then the opposite will be the other. But in general, if it's a big controversial issue, then the community does work very hard on that. And it's not always easy. So to give a really difficult contemporary example, is the question of Crimea and Russian Wikipedia, Ukrainian Wikipedia, English Wikipedia. You know, there, like, the communities, the Russians and Ukrainians have really tried to work together. There's been a lot of dialogue between them to try to say, like, we need these two, they need to describe the dispute, but in a way that everybody can understand what the various sides are. And so we work hard on that kind of thing, but sometimes we don't quite get it right. A few years back, I met as a member of parliament in Lithuania, who one of his things, he was on the board of the Lithuanian Official Encyclopedia Project, which they were, I think it shut down soon after. But and he was a very scholarly guy, and he spoke several languages. And he was talking about a battle in the 1800s between Lithuania and Poland, and he said, "Well, I went to the Lithuanian version, and it just mainly told the Lithuanian story. I went to the Polish version; it told the Polish story. Went to the German version, and it was just very short. They didn't have much about it. And then the English version, he said, was amazing, because in the English version, it actually explained the historical
the context
sort of disagreements,
and all of that,
right?
Yeah.
And so there is apparently a legitimate scholarly debate around some details of this battle. And the English one, and he said it felt to him like the English Wikipedia is where the Lithuanians and Poles came together and kind of compromised and found an answer. And I said, well, yeah, that's probably right. And quite possibly that should make its way now into Polish and Lithuanian, where they acknowledge that there is a historical dispute. And people are actually quite good about that. It's easier if it's a dispute about something from 1850, right? It's much harder if it's a contemporary dispute.
Israel-Palestine, for example.
Israel-Palestine.
Which is an incredibly well-worded article. I read that last night.
Yeah. And I do think on certain entries, you know, where there is a big controversy, there's so many people who are really focused on it and really committed to that idea of we should neutrally explain the various positions and the agreed facts. That, and it's one of the great strengths of Wikipedia. I always say, like, if you turn on TV news in the U.S. and you're trying to understand Obamacare, for example, well, good luck. It's quite a complex set of – it's not just one simple law. It's a huge sort of set of policies. You know, if you really want to understand it, hopefully you turn to Wikipedia and you'll get a good description of what all the moving parts are. And
it would immediately redirect to the Affordable Care Act page, which, of course, you get these vox pops on American telly where they say, I didn't like Obamacare, but they're not going to take away my Affordable Care Act. I've got coverage.
Exactly, exactly.
You edit Wikipedia yourself every day, don't you? What pages are you most interested in?
Most of my editing at Wikipedia is talking to the community. So I get involved in policy debates, and I kind of view my role there as always trying to push us back to our core values of neutrality, of social policies around being nice to people, basically. And then I do edit occasionally, just out of interest. So one of the things that I was doing for a while, but I haven't done lately, I changed web browsers and lost my bookmark, but I had bookmarked...
I'm glad that happens to proper web people as well.
I had constructed a bookmark. It was actually a little bit tricky to figure out how to do it, where when I clicked that bookmark, it would take me to a random page in a category, and the category was British women novelists, because one of the things that I'm aware of is that Wikipedia does have a gender imbalance problem, and that gender imbalance problem is reflected in the content in various ways. And one of the specific ways is that, you know, if you look at novelists who have won important literary awards and you look at the female novelists and the male novelists tend to have much longer biographies. Somebody did a study showing this. And I can tell you, I know hundreds of Wikipedia editors. It is not because the male Wikipedia editors think female novelists are not worth reading or they're useless.
Is it an unconscious bias?
It's an unconscious bias. People write about the books they've read, and turns out there is a gender imbalance in the quality novels. There is such a thing as, you know, literature that is written by women and more read by women than men. Okay. But that shouldn't be reflected as a bias in Wikipedia. So I thought, well, I should on a regular basis take a look at these articles and, you know, click the page and just say, okay, well, here's a short entry. I'll go and do 10 minutes of research and see if I can find some basic facts to add to the articles. So I've done things like that, and I think that's an interesting thing to do. Other than that, you know, it's kind of random, like whatever I come across that looks like it needs fixing. So
what else needs fixing? Because there's plenty of other stuff to ask you about. So I want to kind of just have a few final questions on Wikipedia. But what else is wrong with Wikipedia? What's top of your to-do list now to fix?
Well, I think the gender imbalance is important, and it's something that we are trying to focus more on, but it's a tough problem. I think that the growth of Wikipedia in the developing world is really important. So it's not that it's necessarily broken, but in some cases I think we could do better. And figuring out how to help some of these small languages grow. A lot of the assumptions that we would have haven't proven to be true. It's not so simple. I mean, one example is that the next billion people to come online are going to come online mostly on mobile. And mobile editing is quite hard, probably always will be quite hard. And so the assumption that, well, look, as people come online, they're going to start working in Wikipedia. Well, there's probably some truth to that, but we shouldn't assume that it's going to take the same path that, you know, we started in English and then quickly launched in German, French, and other European languages. And, you know, you shouldn't assume like, oh, well, the Romanians, you know, they got around to it eventually, and they've got their Romanian language Wikipedia, and it's doing well. And you can't necessarily assume that all languages are going to follow that path. So I think we need to do more in that area.
How involved were you personally in terms of removing the Daily Mail as a credible and trustworthy source? That caused a bit of a furore.
Not at all, really. I would say that my only involvement was, I'd say it was about 5 years ago, I was just opining about something and I said, I don't even understand why we accept the Daily Mail as a source for anything, ever. And that was 5 years before, so I don't think it had direct causal connection, although it was quoted by some in that. And I don't make editorial policy in a top-down way at all. That's just not how Wikipedia works. So I have influence, but, you know, it's not... It's just...
There's clearly a latency of 5 years.
It's very slow, slow influence. But what's interesting is, of course, that has caused quite a, you know, a dust-up here in the UK. And it's been interpreted by some as being political, that we're against the political bias of the Daily Mail. But it really doesn't have anything to do with that. It has to do with accuracy. And the issue there is, you know, that the Daily Mail has a lot of problems with accuracy. And, of course, they get very upset when you say that, but it's just a simple fact.
I agree with you.
I can show you lots of examples.
I don't need them.
And they like to brag about, oh, there are only this many complaints to the press commission.
So, never wrong for long and all that kind of
thing. Never wrong for long. But what my experience has been is that if they've run something that's wrong, they will correct it if somebody might be about to sue them. And where things linger on their site as wrong for very long is – things where there's no one to sue because it's just a wrong story about, you know. And so some people who have said, oh, I don't think you should have done that and so on. I said, well, look, all right, imagine this. There's just been an announcement of a new academic paper in Science or Nature about a new cancer treatment. Do you think we should maybe use that paper as a source for Wikipedia, or should we use the Daily Mail's write-up and sensational, you know? No, yeah. Obviously. I mean, if you stop and think about that for a second, you think, oh, okay, actually. Now, the Daily Mail, it's not 100% banned as a source. It's discouraged.
It's contextual.
But there's cases where, of course, you would cite the Daily Mail, and, you know, that can be fine. But in general, their style is not encyclopedic, and, you know, we're really looking for basic facts, not the Daily Mail spin on those facts. And I think they should just get over this. Like, it's not, you know, it's no harm to the Daily Mail. Their sales are fine, you know.
When you said the Daily Mail's style is not encyclopedic, I was picturing the sidebar of shame and all their obsession with female celebrities putting on a pound and all that.
I mean, that is
quite the opposite, as far removed from encyclopedic as you can get. It actually brings me to your current project, Wiki Tribune. I mean, you're effectively saying the news is broken and we can fix it. That's a pretty tough ask.
Mm. Yeah, so the concept of Wiki Tribune is to bring together, paid professional journalists to work side by side as equals with the community and to really try to do something new. And so there's a couple of things going on here. So there have been a lot of different ideas and projects of citizen journalism, and some of those have worked and some of those have been fine, but the idea that we're in the future there won't be any professional journalists and citizens will just report on the world themselves is unrealistic. We're not moving in that direction. And there's limits to what people can do. So the reason for that is if you're just an ordinary person who's intelligent and thoughtful and you're sitting at home and you may be a very good writer, okay, you're working part-time because you're doing it just as a hobby for fun at night on the weekends or whatever. How are you going to interview Boris Johnson, right? It's not really possible. You might have to travel a long distance to do that and take time off of work. And plus, how are you going to get through? And that's part of what is not easy to do from home. There's a lot of other things, but there are things that people can do and that people have done very well. So, you know, some examples, some fantastic examples of what I might call data journalism, going through huge piles of documents and things like this and really helping sort through and sift through things takes a lot of people. It's something that's very hard for newspapers to invest money in. Some of them do, but it's hard. And getting the help of the public to go through some kind of data dump seems quite useful. Other things would have to do with sub-editing, you know, basically copy editing, basically looking for bias. We know that the Wikipedia community is very, very good at, as you say, taking an entry Israel-Palestine, very good at going through and looking and toning down the language and really trying to be very precise with the language. That's something that communities are very good at. A genuine commitment to neutrality. And so I think that's very interesting. But I think the real issue is that to the extent that we've gone down a path of an advertising-only business model, and fortunately, we're seeing a lot of newspapers begin to move away from that successfully. But the advertising-only business model has been really devastating for quality news reporting, simply because your incentives in that world are to basically get as many clicks as possible. And this has actually gotten worse in recent years. So one of the big trends in the world of online advertising is programmatic advertising, which is basically, to make it very simple, it's much more sophisticated targeting. So I'll use myself as an example. Everywhere I go on the web, I see more or less the same ads.
Me too.
About boats.
Are you a boatman?
I love boats, right? So I read boat magazines. I look at boats online. And the ads, I click on them. It's boats I can't afford. So it's like boat porn, but that's great. You know, so I click and go.
But then the algorithm now thinks you can afford them.
And they think I might. So, you know, they show me the ads. And so everywhere I go, I get the same ads. So that means I could be at The Guardian, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, random gossip website, whatever it might be, I get more or less the same ads everywhere I go, which means the boat people aren't thinking as they might have in the past. They're like, we need to sell boats. Let's advertise in the FT and the Economist because some of those city boys have a lot of money and they like boats. And that's not what they're doing. They're just like, who likes boats?
Yeah,
and
we're searching for boats.
Shove that up.
But there's no context, is there?
Because no context, right? And it turns out it doesn't matter that much. So There you go. So that means for news, it's really about the clicks. I keep talking about this example, which I can't find. So maybe if somebody is listening to this, they can help me find this example. But read this sort of short little article or essay. It was from an online quality news source, magazine. So it could have been Salon, Atlantic. I can't remember exactly where I saw it. But the story they told was very interesting and really caused kind of a light bulb in my mind. They said, look, we've had an investigative journalist working on a story for 3 weeks, a senior journalist, and published a story that we're quite proud of, and it had an impact, and it was important news. Nothing, you know, earth-shattering, didn't, you know, it's not going to get Trump impeached or something, but, you know, an important news story. And it got a lot of traffic, so that was good. You know, we were happy about that. The same day we published that, we had a millennial intern in the office write a listicle or something, like one of these puffy little with clickbaity headline and so on. It went viral. It got the same amount of traffic, and it cost us almost nothing. So they're basically saying, look, we're going to keep doing the good journalism. But they're just saying, well, we're putting our hand up here to say, look, this isn't working. Like, the business model is pushing us in a direction that we don't want to go in. And I think that's really important, that if you get, you know, quality news sources who decide to, you know, as you talked about the Daily Mail sidebar of shame, you know, there's no question why they're doing that. It's all about clicks. It's all about just, you know, and I think we've all been there. You go to read, oh, what's the headline? Theresa May, something, something. And then you click on some bikini picture and you're like, oh, what am I doing with my life?
And yeah, and it's always actually usually some female C-list celebrity that's put weight on or something in your bikini
yeah,
shot. And you
dreadful,
even feel bad
yeah.
clicking on it, but you also think, oh, she has put weight on, hasn't she? It's awful, really. That's presumably why they call it the sidebar of shame.
The ones that I'm quite guilty of is, you know, you won't believe what such and such celebrity looks like now. And it's somebody from the 70s
Elizabeth
from a
Shue
sitcom.
I clicked on yesterday.
Yeah, you know, it's like, how would Stable Hasselhoff look like now, you know?
Terrible.
It's usually female celebrities that they do this with. And you click because you're like, yeah, actually, what does Marianne from Gilligan's Island look like now? And then I've learned something. If I see one like that and I'm tempted, when you click through, they inevitably show you have to click like 30 times to see what she looks like now. It's just like a retrospective of her career in pictures.
It's
you know?
The clicks they want, the physical clicking.
The physical clicks. And so instead I just go to Google and say, what does Marianne from Gilligan's Island look like now? And then there's the picture.
Idea.
And I'm like, oh, okay, that's what she looks like now. Great. Now I'm back to work. You know.
So but do you think this challenges the, I mean, clearly it challenges the business model of the traditional news media.
Yeah.
Do you think this is a huge threat?
I think it is a huge threat. And so with Wiki Tribune, we've launched with no ads and we're asking people to sign up as monthly supporters because I think that will drive us in a different direction. So the incentives of the Wiki Tribune journalists will be, look, at the end of reading an article, if people say, wow, that was good, that was worth reading, I want to support this, then we've accomplished it. It's not just about getting you to click and share with your friends, a very lightweight interaction. It's about saying the only way we can make any money, the only way we can be sustainable is by producing things that people are willing to pay for. And that's a completely different model. And I'm happy to say, look, this is not unique, and actually we're seeing a lot of success. So the New York Times, saw some figures the other day, they've gone from something like 1 million online subscriptions to 1.8 million in about a year's time. So, okay, that's huge, right? That's really important because that means the New York Times will be less sort of pushed to go down that clickbait route, and they can stick to what they do best.
It's one of the reasons I subscribed.
Yep.
We had Mark Thompson, the CEO, sitting in that very chair recently,
yeah.
And he was saying that far from President Trump saying they're failing, that business has never been better for them.
No, it's really fantastic, and it's been a long time coming. So the Guardian, I was on the board of the Guardian, really loved that experience, decided I have to leave the board as I'm launching a news site, but The Guardian has been doing this, you know, reader revenue membership campaign, asking people to contribute, and it's incredibly successful. That's grown a lot for them. I'm hopeful that it's going to make a huge impact in the long run for the Guardian. The Guardian still struggles financially, and people, please go and sign up for the Guardian.
You
can only sell Auto Trader once, exactly. You know, the Guardian deserves support and needs support. And I think what we all should think about is to say, well, look, we really don't want these great institutions to
wither on the vine.
And that's not a political, you know, if you don't like the Guardian, then support the Telegraph. I'm fine with that. You know, support whatever quality newspaper you prefer. Just do it. And one of the things that has been interesting is that the financial papers have done very well with paywalls, and they're fairly expensive. Mm-hmm. But there's something subtly different about a financial paper. So when I subscribe to a financial paper, I'm doing it as an investment. As a work thing. In my career, I'm going to learn something that's useful in business. And when I'm in that mode, I think of it as a business expense, and it's something that I need to do. But also, I don't mind if other people are reading it or not. In fact, we kind of hope they're not, because you're trying to get an advantage, right?
Exactly.
You want to know, you want to be, you go into a meeting, you want to know what's the latest news in business, and you want to be ahead of your competitors, and that's great. But with The Guardian, for example, or The New York Times, it's not that I want to have special information that no one else has. It's that I want The Guardian to tell the world. So when they were doing the reporting on, one of my personal favorites was the reporting on Snowden and all that. Like, that's important work. And it's not about, I want to get access to that and I don't care if anybody else does. No, I want the world to know. This is like investigative journalism. It's good for society. And so a paywall model isn't really what I'm after. Actually, The Guardian is worth nothing to me if it's 100% behind a paywall. Like, okay, well, that's fine, but I want you to be influential and I want you to be open. And so I should pay not because I have to, because of paywall. I should pay because I want to.
What is a typical week for you? You must have a lot of Weekly Tribune, Wikipedia. Do you have other things that pay your rent, or do you kind of sell the big issue to get food? What is a typical week? And are you an honorary Brit now? Because you seem to be in Britain all the time. Why have you chosen us? We've got Brexit and Trump as president. You're an immigrant. You should go back to your own country.
Exactly. Well, my wife is English, so I moved there because of her. And she, at the time, had just landed landed a big job. She was doing the communications for the torch relay for the Olympics. So she, she just landed this big client, and so she needed to be here. And I was like, well, that's fine. I can be anywhere. So moved here. And I really do like living in the UK. Because my wife, she worked at Number 10 for a long time. She worked with Tony Blair back in the day. So she knows everybody. So it was, it's like all super interesting to be here. So a typical week for me, I'm not sure there is a typical week. There's certainly not really a typical day, but I travel a lot. I travel and I do speeches. When we finish this podcast today, I'm jumping on a plane. I'm going to Saudi Arabia for a UNESCO event.
Wow.
And speaking there.
I'm going to Pret-a-Manger to buy an avocado sandwich. I'm living the dream, not you.
Amazing. Avocado sandwich sounds quite good. I haven't had breakfast, really. I did have a little
We should have laid on some pastries then.
No, avocado sandwich. So I travel a lot for Wikipedia. I sometimes have sort of a diplomatic job, a diplomatic role with Wikipedia. So, well, this week the big news has been that Wikipedia is blocked in Turkey, and it's a bit soon to know what's going to happen there. We're filing an appeal and so on. But I'm involved in talking to the government, planning at the moment to go there in a couple weeks' time to visit with the relevant people. And that's, I try to bring goodwill and sort of remind people how important Wikipedia is to the world and try to do these things. But, those kinds of issues are quite easy for us in one sense, because we are incredibly principled about this. We won't accept censorship of Wikipedia anywhere. And so we're blocked in China. And, any government that says to us, oh, no, we don't like this, we say, look, if it's within our own policies that some content is violating our policies, then yes, we'll take it down. But
you can't take it down because you don't like it.
Generally, right, exactly. So it's tough. These are tough negotiations. We're not going to meet them in the middle. We're going to say no. We're not going to delete two pages from English Wikipedia because the Turkish government doesn't like them. That's never going to happen. So now let's have a conversation about how can you change your laws? That's sort
of how can you be less of a dick?
Well, I'm a little more
country.
Diplomatic.
Well, of course. Yeah. Well, that's why you're doing it, and I'm not.
So there's that. Obviously, these days I'm working very hard here in London on Weekly Tribune and getting that launched. We're doing a crowdfunding campaign to launch it, because although I could go out and get investors, I really want to sort of really go down a path, a very independent path, to so I can really do it my way and not have to be thinking about, you know, how do I optimize revenue for to please the investors. It's more like, how do I make the thing I want? And it has to be sustainable. There has to be revenue, but how can I do that? And I feel, at least for now, I want to get it up to a point where, you know, I can really feel confident that we can do that. What else do I do? Well, I was until recently, I was on the board of The Guardian, which I really enjoyed.
Somewhat of a sacrifice to stand down for the because you believe in this project.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's altruism.
It was, yeah, maybe not, but no, but it was actually something that I felt like, you know, I really loved. I loved The Guardian. I loved being on the board of The Guardian. Learned a lot. I felt like I was helpful there, but just needed to do this thing, and so, you know, we parted on very good company, but I don't think The Guardian's afraid of my competition, really. There's a lot of newspapers out there, and my little thing isn't going to bother anybody for a while. So, yeah, I don't know. I do lots of stuff. I get a lot of email.
Indeed, and I have emailed you myself in the past asking you to come on this very podcast. I'm very grateful you have. Well, yeah. Last question then. What's your first thought when you get out of bed on a morning? Are you reacting to stuff, or do you think, right, how can I make the world better, if that doesn't sound almost too clichéd?
Well, yeah, so sometimes there's reacting. I mean, you know, we've discussed the Wikipedia community choosing not to accept the Daily Mail as a source. I had no idea that was about to happen. I rolled out of bed one morning and sort of looked at the Guardian app on my phone, as I always do. And
your top story.
And Wikipedia bans Daily Mail. Oh, God, for f***'s sake, I'm on vacation. Like, now I'm going to have to kind of warn me, people, but no.
Founder of Wikipedia unbans Daily Mail for a week
for a week.
He can do his vacation.
I'm on holiday. But, you know, I woke up and saw Turkey is blocking Wikipedia. I'm like, okay, this is going to be a chunk of work this week. But in general, so when I have a so-called normal day here in London, I actually have quite a regular routine. I have my alarm set for 6:25 in the morning. I used to be 6:30, but I just felt I needed 5 extra more minutes. So get up at 6:25, go downstairs, make coffee, get myself a bit of yogurt, read the headlines, you know, get on my phone, check my email quickly. And then at 7 is when I wake up my daughter, who's in year one at school, and bring her downstairs and give her breakfast and sort of start chivvying her to
manager,
get
basically.
Dressed.
Yeah,
exactly. And I'm supposed to bring my wife tea at 7:15, but this morning I forgot, so she was a bit late. It was a bit frantic this morning, and that's kind of like my morning routine. And then I'm off to work. And then my days in London are quite varied. I mean, recently I've been going a lot to Impossible Labs. So this is my friends Lily and Kwame very generously have been helping me get Wiki Tribune launched. And so I'm sort of camped out in their office working on things and raising the money to get this going. So we're going to be hunting for our own offices and so forth. So anyway, it's quite varied, but I super busy all the time.
Jimmy, I could talk for another hour, but unfortunately we've run out of metaphorical tape, so thank you ever so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Very good. Thanks for having me.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things!